U.S. talks to normalize ties with Israel. Iran's nuclear chief slams Western countries for using the mechanisms of the International Atomic Energy Agency to exert political pressure on Tehran. And the Venezuelan president accuses Guyana of allowing the U.S. to use it as a military base amid a dispute between the two neighbors over resource-rich waters. This is News. Thanks for joining us. In a rare visit, a Saudi delegation is now in the occupied West Bank to meet Palestinian officials. The delegation is being led by the non-resident Saudi ambassador to the Palestinian territories, Nayef al-Sudairi. He is scheduled to meet President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh. The visit is the first by such Saudi delegation to the West Bank in the past 3 decades. It comes amid talks between Saudi Arabia and Israel to normalize ties. Those talks are brokered by the U.S. Let's bring some analysis into this. Moti Abu Musaba is a Palestinian political activist who joins us from Gaza City. Moti Abu Musaba, welcome. What is your reading into this visit by the Saudi delegation, which is the first in 3 decades?
Okay, first of all, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to join you. I would like just to say that any normalization agreement is considered as a stab in the back of the Palestinian people. These agreements are totally rejected by the Palestinian people because it's seen and understood. These agreements are seen and understood by the Israeli occupation as a green line to commit more and more crimes against the Palestinian people. And if we had a look on the course of the crimes committed and perpetrated against the Palestinian people after signing those abhorrent normalization agreements, we would witness a surge and an increase of those crimes. So this means clearly that the Israeli occupation tries and attempts to exploit and to take advantage of any kind of normalization to gain more time, in order to entrench the occupation on the back of the Palestinian people. This is on one hand, and simply, generally, those Arab countries who signed normalization agreements with the Israeli occupation, they have never gained any interest in return for those agreements. So the main beneficial of those agreements is the Israeli occupation, because as I've mentioned, any agreement actually gives the Israeli occupation a green light to keep committing its crimes against the Palestinian people and to keep entrenching the occupation on the Palestinian land. This is on one hand. On the other hand, we as Palestinian people cannot accept by any means for the Palestinian cause to be exploited and to be used by any Arab regime or by any regime over the world in order to achieve their political or their strategic accomplishments on the back of the Palestinian people. The cause of the Palestinian people is a political, humanitarian cause, and the Palestinian people needs a real solution that stops the Israeli aggression, that guarantees the Palestinian people to live in freedom and to live freely on their land. But on the other hand, we cannot, as I've mentioned, this is totally rejected to be to use the Palestinian cause as a trump for the Arab countries. Instead of signing these agreements, we need to have a just solution for the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people are waiting from the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in front of the Israeli occupation, not signing normalization agreements with the Israeli occupation, because this actually means that the Palestinian people are facing the Israeli occupation alone in the battle and in the struggle for their freedom.
Very well. Thank you very much for that, Moti Abu Musaba, Palestinian political activist. We appreciate your thoughts. Iran's nuclear chief has strongly criticized the West for trying to exert pressure on the Islamic Republic by abusing the mechanisms of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Mohammed Aslami says Western countries resort to political means and sanctions to achieve their goal. He urged IAEA to maintain its impartiality and professionalism and to not allow the West to use the agency's reports as an excuse to put pressure on Tehran. Islami said the West's brutal political pressure on Iran has been futile, and the Islamic Republic will not leave such animosity unanswered. He was speaking in a meeting with IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi on the sidelines of the 67th regular session of the agency's General Conference in Vienna. Earlier on Monday, Islami also raised the alarm about the threats posed by Israel's nuclear arsenal.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is the initiator of the notion of establishing a region free of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, once again expresses its serious concerns about the secret militarized nuclear program of the Zionist Israeli regime. Unfortunately, by refusing to join the NPT, this regime has not placed its nuclear activities and sites under the safeguard system. As a result, it is considered an internal threat to international peace and security.
Islami added that Israel continues terrorist measures against Iranian nuclear scientists and the country's peaceful nuclear sites. Iran's nuclear chief called on the IAEA to show a serious reaction to such moves. He also condemned recent remarks by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has said that Iran, quote, must face a credible nuclear threat.
Undoubtedly, the silence of the international community in the face of the repeated threats issued by this regime has resulted in its recent brazenness. It is evident that the Islamic Republic of Iran reserves the right to respond to the brazenness of the Zionist regime.
Islami also touched upon Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA. He stressed U.S. sanctions have failed to prevent the development of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran says it foiled attacks planned by Daesh-affiliated terrorists in the capital, Tehran, earlier this month. Iran's judiciary spokesman, Masoud Setayeshi, said the terrorists wanted to carry out those attacks during the ceremony marking Arbaeen and several other gatherings ahead of the new school year. He said the terrorists had prepared explosive devices, including bombs and suicide vests. At least 30 terrorists have been arrested by the country's security forces. The revelation came one day after the intelligence ministry said it had thwarted a terrorist plot aimed at setting off 30 simultaneous explosions in Tehran. Armenia says over 13,000 refugees have arrived from Nagorno-Karabakh following last week's military operation by Azerbaijan to take full control of the disputed region. Yerevan says the first batch of displaced ethnic Armenians arrived on Sunday. That after the Armenian government announced plans to relocate those were made homeless by the military operation. The Armenian Prime Minister has also warned that ethnic cleansing is underway in the region. But Azerbaijan says it wants to reintegrate ethnic Armenians as equal citizens. Envoys from Yerevan and Baku will hold EU-backed talks in Brussels later on Tuesday. The Nagorno-Karabakh region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but is home to a majority of some 120,000 ethnic Armenians. And staying with Nagorno-Karabakh, an explosion at a fuel depot has killed 20, injuring hundreds more. The blast took place near the regional capital of Stepanakert on Monday evening. Local officials say 13 unidentified bodies were found at the scene and 7 more died in the hospital. Nearly 300 people have been admitted to the hospitals, with dozens of them in critical condition. The cause of the blast remains unknown. China has warned against what it calls the wanton expansion of military alliances, indirectly taking a jibe at the U.S. that is deepening its security ties in the Asia-Pacific region. Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China will stand against the growing military alliances and the squeezing of the security space of other countries in the region. The warning echoes China's long-held criticism of U.S.'s efforts to shore up alliances in the region. In April, the Chinese defense minister said establishing NATO-like military alliances in the Asia-Pacific will plunge the region into a whirlpool of conflicts. Meanwhile, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman urged Washington to abandon its Cold War mentality and to refrain from provoking an arms race in Asia.
China hopes that when developing bilateral relations and conducting military cooperation, relevant countries will effectively abide by the basic norms of international relations, abandon hegemony and Cold War thinking, stop provoking confrontation and stimulating arms races, and do not harm regional peace, stability, development, and prosperity.
Wang was responding to a question about reported talks between the U.S. and Vietnam for an arms deal. Last week, American officials said the administration of President Joe Biden is negotiating to supply Vietnam with a large arms package, including F-16 fighter jets. The deal could possibly be the largest arms transfer in history between the two countries. Political commentator Ding Heng joined us earlier from Beijing. He said Washington's actions in the Asia-Pacific contradict his claims about stabilizing ties with China. He also said the U.S. military-industrial complex is the main benefactor of rising tensions in the world.
I think, first of all, it is an open secret that the U.S. military-industrial complex, let's put it in this way, represents a big shadow in Washington's foreign policy. That's true in any administration's era. And so more regional tensions elsewhere are, of course, in the interests of the U.S. military-industrial complex, because as a result, they will gain from this. And I think from China's perspective, this is really looking to be part of the Biden administration's effort to shore up alliances and partnerships in the Asia-Pacific region to counter China. Washington has been doing this since Biden came into office by seeking to work with countries like Japan, South Korea, as well as the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. Now, rhetorically, the Biden administration officials claim that they want to stabilize the ties with China, but their real action sometimes would give you a different impression. Vietnam is unlikely to board the U.S. vessel when we talk about countering China or containing China in this region, not only because of the, you know, brutal history between Vietnam and the United States, but also realistically between China and Vietnam, there is a huge economic and trade stake here.
The Venezuelan president has accused Guyana of allowing the U.S. to turn the South American country into a military base amid a territorial dispute between the two neighbors.
Guyana has decided to take over the sea by the force. ExxonMobil has bought all of Guyana's ruling elite's politicians. ExxonMobil and the United States Southern Command, who have turned Guyana into a U.S. military base, intend to take Venezuela's sea. They intend to take over the unbounded sea by the force in a barbaric way, the colonialist way. And then they say they are victims, saying that Venezuela is threatening them.
Maduro said Venezuela does not threaten anyone. He said the Essequibo region historically belongs to his country. However, he said that Venezuela is willing to talk to Guyana to settle the dispute. Last week, the Guyanese president, Irfan Ali, claimed that Venezuela is trying to undermine his country's territorial integrity. Ali's remarks at the UN General Assembly came after Caracas, in a communique, said that Guyana has no sovereign rights over the maritime areas. Guyana has recently opened bids for offshore oil blocks in the region. The move has reignited the dispute over the oil-rich Essequibo region, which dates back to the 18th century. The cost of living crisis in the UK isn't just making life difficult, but also shorter. That's according to a study which has found that the inflation-fueled scourge will cause thousands of premature deaths and significantly widen the wealth and health gap between the richest and the poorest. The modeling study suggests the number of people dying before the age of 75 will rise 6.5% this year due to the sustained period of high prices. It also forecasts that the most deprived households will experience four times more deaths than their wealthiest counterparts. The findings were published in the journal BMJ Public Health. Researchers stressed that implemented public policy responses are insufficient to protect health and to prevent widening inequalities. Millions of Britons have been hit hard by levels of inflation not seen since the 1970s. Poor households have borne the brunt as they spend a larger portion or proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Our correspondent in London, Rob Carter, earlier joined us to talk more about the UK's cost of living crisis.
The situation in the UK is really bad at the moment. For example, the inflation rate has dropped since August. It reached highs of around 11%. Now it's dropped around 6%. But despite that, it remains the highest out of all the G7 members. So that just shows you the unique and depressing situation that the UK finds itself in comparison to other major economies, particularly in the Western world, particularly in Europe. Obviously, the ongoing war in Ukraine as well as having a major depressing effect on the economy, and Britain again remains one of the key players pushing and encouraging that conflict and trying to throw more money, more military means at that conflict whilst ordinary Britons continue to suffer here. So this is going to affect the weakest in society more so. The elderly especially are very vulnerable. Poor families are incredibly vulnerable. And of course, this recent study shows that the poor households are going to be affected with significantly more premature deaths, which they're crediting to the cost of living crisis, especially. So incredibly desperate and depressing times to be living in the poorer parts of Britain at the moment. And of course, minority communities are expected to suffer much more.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has announced the arrival of the first batch of U.S.-made Abrams battle tanks in Kyiv. Zelensky did not mention the number of tanks or the time they will join the brigades in the front line. According to U.S. officials, the tanks are armed with 120-millimeter rounds of depleted uranium, strong enough to pierce conventional tank armor. The deployment comes less than a week after U.S. President Joe Biden announced plans for the delivery in a meeting with the Ukrainian president. This is part of a $43 billion security assistance promised by Washington. Russia has reacted to the delivery of the Abrams tanks to Ukraine. It says the move will have no impact on its military operation and that the tanks will burn in Ukraine. And that does it for this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. On today's show, we will discuss the role of the media. The study of mainstream media's role during the recent conflict in Ireland has been a source of interest around the world. Historically, state interference in broadcasting underscored the perceived dangers in allowing alternative, radical voices to challenge the political status quo. These measures were seen to be a pragmatic approach in dealing with organisations that were seen to be willing to subvert the democratic institutions of the land. My next guest could be seen to be a central figure in the battle of narratives during the conflict. Before I introduce today's guest, we'd get the public's take on how much faith they have in the media.
No, I don't have much faith in the media. I think, well, some of it paints a false image of life. I think it's altered to suit whoever is broadcasting it and whatever is the agenda behind it, so no.
If I'm perfectly honest, I would say no. I would say no. I'm very angry sometimes at the headlines I see in newspapers like the Mail, the Sun, and the other rubbish right-wing press. The Guardian. Yeah, but on the whole, no. I think it's all controlled. The BBC is, at the moment, I think the BBC is appalling. Programmes that people used to watch, Question Time, is a prime example. Question Time now should just be called Tory Time, because that's all it is. So the bottom line to that is, have I got faith in the media?
No.
Believe that the media can be used for good, especially in terms of reporting on campaigns by community groups or local organisations, the likes of that. But I also believe the media is very often used as the biggest tool in distraction and culture wars. And most of the time, the stuff we're seeing on the media is sensationalised. Maybe the emphasis is put on the wrong things to distract from cases of other maybe marginalisation or corruption in government or in companies, organisations that are functioning on a much higher level than community and aren't based in grassroots community work. And as I said, the media is very often used to perpetrate certain things that distract regular people on the ground from the real problems that are going on.
I do have faith in the media in many ways. Especially with, you know, recent events that happened there through being contacted through the media, with being attacked by loyalist youths and stuff. But it has its negatives too. You have to be extra careful of, you know, there's a lot of negative and, you know, lies being put out through the media as well. So you have to be extra careful of what who's right and who's wrong. So it's very, very important that you get the right information. But it's crucial. And I think it's, you know, you'd be lost without it, to be truthful.
Not particularly. Well, growing up here in Northern Ireland and stuff, what I've seen myself, for myself, and then looking at the media and their narrative, then that's, I've grew sceptical over the years. And then the last load of years here with COVID and Russia, Ukraine, stuff like that there, it's made me even more sceptical.
As always, we're joined by our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. She's been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest needs no introduction in Ireland. He is a former IRA prisoner, director of publicity for Sinn Féin and editor of the political newspaper and Phoblacht. He is now also an accomplished author and playwright. Please welcome Donnie Morrison.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Donnie, do you recall when you became first enamoured by the world of publicity?
Well, it was a very long time ago. I think it was actually in primary school. Beside me in class was a very rich kid called Joe McGee. And Joe asked me to write comics. And so I drew the comics and put in my own text and dialogue. And in every comic, Joe was the hero at the end of the story. But I suppose I was also attractive. I mean, I was studying English at school, and then in 1968, I was involved with a group, cross-community group of people who were amateur ham. We built our own pirate radio stations, which went on the air after Radio Ulster went off. And basically, we were nerds. We just talked about electronic parts, etc. But whenever the crisis came in August 1969, and our areas were attacked and the barricades went up, I was asked by an IRA man, would I be prepared to put my transmitter behind the barricades as Radio Free Belfast? So my transmitter was operating from above the Long Bar in Leeson Street. And interestingly enough, I had worked with the owner of the Long Bar, Paddy Lenehan, and his daughter became the future President of Ireland, Mary McAleese. So we were working. I put the transmitter in that station, and it would broadcast proper news. It would quell any rumours about, you know, false rumours going around about an attack on an area. We give out GAA results, and I also remember which I consider to be quite sad, plaintive in a way. I remember going down to the radio station, Radio Free Belfast, one day, and there was a whole pile of kids standing down the landing, right onto the street, with tiny bits of paper. And it was requests for their mother or their granny, it was their birthday, would you play such and such an Irish song? And, you know, it just struck me that our music had never been played on the radio in the north or on television, just as there was massive restrictions on reporting GAA games because of the British culture of this state and the anti-niceness sentiment within it. So I was involved in that, and then I secretly sold Republican News from underneath my coat outside St Paul's Chapel. The British Army were already in at that stage. They'd already taken, come into our areas and built barracks, etc. And then run up the internment, or just after internment, each area in Belfast, each Republican area, produced its own little news sheet, sort of mosquito press. Gestetner produced these very simple magazines, which would, you know, express solidarity with the internees and give local gossip and things like that, local jokes, give a platform to some kid, maybe who was a good cartoonist. So I was involved in writing for it. And then it came sort of a personal crisis in my life where my friends were getting arrested and tortured. The British Army were sealing off the streets and doing house-to-house searches. They were personally very aggressive with us and very violent with us. And I was studying, at this stage, I was studying A-level English and History at the College of Business Studies. And I just realised I couldn't go on with that. So I just walked out of the college and got involved with the Republican movement. And by the end of 1972, I was in Longcash as an internee. I became the PRO in Cage 2. And I also met a man called Francis Brawley, who was a school teacher who was interned. And he was very, very encouraging because I wanted to be a writer. And he was very, he encouraged me, and he went over stories that I had written. So I got released from internment, but I was only out 2 or 3 weeks when the British Army came looking for me again. So I was back on the run throughout 1974. And it was only when the IRA called a ceasefire in December 1974 that I was actually able to sort of walk the streets without getting arrested constantly. And it was at that, in the summer of 1975, I was 22 years of age, and I was asked by a veteran Republican, Billy McKee, did I think, could I edit Republican News? You know, and I jumped at it, of course, absolutely no problem, being quite arrogant at that age, you know, quite cocky. I had no experience of how to produce, it was a professionally produced paper. So I became the editor of Republican News. The first thing I did was I wrote into Longcash and asked Jerry Adams, would he write a weekly column for it? And he did, and we started to professionalise the paper. We were operating under severe restrictions. Our office on the Falls Road, there was a loyalist planted a car bomb across the street. Our driver was shot and wounded delivering the papers. The British Army would raid it all the time, seized our photographic archive, seized our equipment, seized our telex machine, and eventually they ended up arresting all of us and charging and putting 14 of us in jail, all related to the publication of Republican News. I defended myself in the Dublock Court, got bail, and we launched a big campaign about free speech, and the British government eventually dropped the charges in 1979.
So, Danny, you were working during that very stringent period of censorship by both the British and Irish governments during the recent conflict. Can you tell us about your role and how that worked out?
Well, they formalised the censorship in 1988, but prior to that, there was, I mean, the BBC and ITN, we were always treated in a hostile fashion in any interview we did. I mean, even if I called a press conference to talk about education or health cuts, the first question on the agenda was, the IRA did this, the IRA did that. And in a sense, they were turning us into proxy IRA spokespersons, and Margaret Thatcher was later to use that that excuse to completely ban Sinn Féin from the airwaves. But prior to that, as I said, they had arrested all of us. Our spokespersons were shot dead. I mean, Maura Drum, the vice president of Sinn Féin, people came into the Hawkmatter Hospital dressed as doctors and killed her in her bed because she was a great spokesperson for our struggle. So we had a real hostile media. The Irish government, of course, you give the lead to the British in this respect. They introduced the Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act in 1972 as soon as they could, because what they did not want was the people in the south of Ireland to hear the truth about what the nationalist community was experiencing, because then that would put an onus on them to do something about it. So instead, they preferred to work in security with the British, security collaboration, and they both then signed up to the same narrative. The Republicans, the nationalist community, were to blame. And what's really interesting is that they totally ignore all the deaths and killings by the state before that. Like Sammy Devaney being beaten to death in his house by the RUC after a civil rights march. Like 9-year-old Patrick Rooney being shot dead in bed by the RUC in August 1969. Which triggered the barricades going up. Like the first British soldier, a Catholic trooper, Hugh McCabe, home on leave, defending the Catholic people in the Falls Road, shot dead by the RUC. So from as far as the British government, the Irish government, and the media, the mainstream media is concerned, they date the trouble from the day that the IRA fires its first shot, which is meant 2 years after all the earlier deaths.
And Donny, many analysts would say that this only streamlined and shaped the party into a more sophisticated political machine. Would you agree with that?
Well, we received no formal training in public relations or in public speaking, so we learnt the hard way. And as I say, we were always treated in a hostile fashion by very polished mainstream British presenters. Who, you know, Oxford, Cambridge and all that, were trained in public speaking and universities, debates, etc. But we learned the hard way. And in fact, we got into a position where we were able to anticipate the next question and were always prepared. We were always complaining to the National Union of Journalists, why aren't you opposing censorship? But in the South, interestingly, they approached Conor Cruise O'Brien, the Minister of Posts and Telegraphs, and they said to him, drop censorship. Let us at Adams and Morrison, we'll take them asunder in the studio. In other words, we'll do your work for you. And Conor Cruise O'Brien turned around and says, you must be joking, they would take you apart.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. Michelle Gildernew and Donny Morrison are my special guests.
We're now living in the digital age. The reach and monopoly of mainstream broadcasters has somewhat waned in recent years. Do you now see the democratisation of various narratives surfacing? Is it easier for marginalised voices to be platformed with the proliferation of digital and social media?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Had we access to Twitter and other social media platforms when the broadcasting ban was introduced in 1988, it would have made it extremely difficult for the British government to have censored us. But before I come to that, I'd just like to speak a bit about what happened in 1988. When Margaret Thatcher brought in the broadcasting ban against Sinn Féin, she says that it would not interfere with the political electoral process because Sinn Féin, in the run-up to an election, would be allowed to take part in party political broadcasts. But as anyone who's involved in politics knows, that you win elections between elections, mm-hmm. not just in the run-up to the election. So that was aimed at hurting us. And even though some conscientious journalists decided to try and make a farce of it by bringing in actors to mimic our words or to put subtitles up, which would presumably alert the public that, hold on a minute, why is there subtitles up? That guy's speaking English. The fact of the matter is that it proved physically very difficult for them to do it when they're approaching a 6 o'clock news deadline at night. So whilst the statistics show from our office the queries to it in the 4 months prior to the introduction of the broadcasting ban, I think we had something like 500-600 inquiries. In the 4 months after it, that had dropped to about 90 or 100. And that also meant that if we weren't on local radio, journalists wouldn't hear that story, and so we'd be missing out on all sorts of ways. So on top of the broadcasting ban, incidentally, I should say this, they also introduced exclusion orders. So I was the director of publicity. I was elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly, and they introduced an exclusion order to keep me from going to England to make a speech. And that exclusion order lasted for 14 years. If I had breached it, I'd have got 5 years in jail for speaking in England. And it was all to deprive the British public access to what was going on. So the censorship applied to the people there, in the sense that they were deprived of hearing alternate views about why their sons and daughters were losing their lives in a foreign war in another country. But the rise of social media, and back then to maintain a presence, we try to bring out weekly videos, and we would give them to the clubs and the pubs. But even that was hard to maintain. We still had our paper on Full Block Republican News. And of course, the British Army and the RUC continually stopped our drivers at checkpoints and tried to deprive people, you know, of a proper service of delivery. So with the rise of social media and with the rise of the internet, I think most opponents of Sinn Féin are of the opinion that Sinn Féin has outshone them all in terms of its mastery of those particular platforms, those medias, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, etc., Facebook. Now, I myself only deal in Twitter. I'm only capable of dealing with one platform at a time. But it's really, it's fantastic, the reach that you can make. Of course, the downside is the proliferation of conspiracy theorists, rumours, misinformation, untruths, mm-hmm. which are really... You spend a lot of your time actually trying to counter that. I simply just block people. Once I suspect people are of a fascist tendency or misogynist or racist and maybe trying to make a clever remark covering it, once I just go into their other messages. If I say anything like that at all, I block it. I don't see why they should be able to reach, you know, 30,000, 40,000 people on my back. So that is an approach that I have. But there's no doubt about it that if we had had Twitter in 1988, we would have defeated the whole purpose of the broadcasting ban.
Yeah. Well, let me put in my next question. So with this proliferation of disinformation, we've seen, for example, the growth of the Red in the Irish Republic, etc., something you wouldn't have seen maybe 10, 15 years ago. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, that's the downside of it. Yeah, there's always two sides to a coin. And the fact of the matter is that they're able to exploit it. They've been able to mobilise people for these, you know, instant protests for where asylum seekers have been allocated maybe rooms in a hotel, even in a small village. Years ago, news like that would never have leaked out. But they're able to instantly respond. So, of course, they're going to take advantage of it. But that's one of the battles that we have to fight. You know, there is an ideological battle going on with them. But I think they've also been fairly countered on social media. They've been exposed. Several of their leaders who, you know, wrap themselves in the tricolour have been exposed with actually having secret contacts with the British National Front, with Nazis. So they haven't been that successful. And I believe, because I believe that our case is morally superior, I think that ultimately we get out the message there with the truth, we will win.
So Danny, we've got you on the show here today. I'd like you to talk a wee bit about the Bobby Sands Trust, of which you're secretary. Can you tell us a bit about it and what your work entails?
Well, back whenever I was the editor of Republican News, I was in constant contact with the prisoners, especially in the run-up to the 1980 hunger strike, so I would have visited Bobby Sands quite regularly. And I'd asked Bobby, would he do some writing for our paper? So using the pen name of Marcella, his sister, he wrote lots of poetry and short stories. And of course he kept a diary for the first 17 days of his hunger strike in 1981, which has never gone out of print. Like 42, 43 years, never gone out of print. And Bobby's lyrics, of course, have been adopted as songs and sang by many thousands of artists around the world, and has been on many CDs, etc. So the Bobby Sands' writings are a very, very important record of the conflict within the prisons, because what was going on in the prisons was also censorship. Mm-hmm. It was an attempt to repudiate that these people were political and had political objectives by trying to say, no, they're criminals, they're ordinary prisoners, when the whole process that they went through, so for example, they were arrested under special laws. They were brought to special interrogation centres where they were questioned under special rules. They then went to non-jury courts where the onus was on the defendant to prove innocence. And then suddenly when they get to this jail, they're no longer special, they're ordinary prisoners. And of course, if you look at Irish history, first hunger striker died in 1917, mm-hmm. Thomas Hoche. So Britain wasn't ignorant of this. They knew what they were doing, and they decided they couldn't defeat the IRA on the streets, so let us try and defeat their prisoners and demoralise their organisation from within. The most vulnerable of people, man in a cell, surrounded by 8 to 10 prison officers, a third of whom were former British soldiers, on big bounties for working in these conditions, and they tried to break the prisoners. So that is a heroic story in itself. What went on in Armagh, women in Armagh jail, and the men, young men, mostly teenagers, many of them, in the H blocks of Lonkesh, just upended British rule in Ireland, the British narrative on Ireland. And you know, Bobby Sands this day is absolutely famous. His name, and people around the world would know his name before they would know Margaret Thatcher's name. Gardens, roads have been named after him when the ANC were preparing a hunger strike. The code word was Sands, etc. So it's quite an honour to be secretary of the Bobby Sands Trust. We preserved as much of his writings that we could. Like he wrote lots of poems on the walls, which were destroyed by prison officers. But he smuggled out letters and poems and songs and two books, you know, the diary and One Day in My Life. We have them in an archive in the National Library in Dublin, and over a period of time, as they become digitalised, we will be putting them for the public to see.
So I believe you have recently written a play, and there's rehearsals occurring presently. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, we're in rehearsals right now. this is a play that I adopted from, well, inspired by a book by a former psychiatric nurse who then became my country and western DJ on local radio. Bobby Hanvey, but there wasn't enough material in his book. So it's set in a psychiatric hospital. It's about a psychiatric nurse. It's set in 1968, just as people are preparing to go on the big march in Derry and Duke Street on the 5th of October, which many people perceive or say is the start of the conflict. First time attacks on our people river filmed, and you saw the RUC baton charging a group of civil rights protesters. So that's it's set in that period, and in parallel with the crisis going on politically, my nurse, Bernard Flanagan, he's also suffering a personal crisis, and towards the end of the play, it all becomes clear as both stories mesh.
Danny, I want to thank you for coming in today. It's always a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you.
We're almost out of time, but I'd like to thank once again our guest Danny Morrison and our resident co-host Michelle Gildernew. Now, the history of Ireland is a rich and vibrant one, and I'd like to share with you a special moment from the vaults, one that involves the most unlikely of encounters.
In 1957, Paul Robeson, the famous American musician and stage actor, released The Ballad of Kevin Barry, an Irish revolutionary song dedicated to the life and death of a young Irish patriot who was hanged by the British government during the War of Independence in 1920. But how did this great musical icon come into the possession of this renowned Irish ballad? According to author Donal O'Driscoll, this was the result of a chance meeting in the most unlikely of circumstances. Padraig O'Donnell, a well-known Irish socialist and a veteran of the Irish War of Independence and Spanish Civil War, embarked on a journey to the United States in 1939. According to O'Driscoll, Potter was stranded at a roadside with a burst tire when a limousine stopped and offered help. He was invited to sit in the car by the passenger while the driver fixed the puncture. The passenger turned out to be Paul Robeson, who told Potter that he would like to record an Irish song. O'Donnell suggested Kevin Barry, the ballad glorifying the young IRA man hanged by the British in 1920, which he said conveyed the spirit of Ireland. He proceeded to teach the song to Robeson. O'Donnell himself went on to become an accomplished novelist and playwright, while Robeson was later persecuted by the FBI and the political right due to his vocal support for the Soviets in the aftermath of the Second World War. He had been impressed by the absence of negative racial attitudes towards him during his visit to the Soviet Union. In the 1950s, McCarthyism and the Red Scare dominated the headlines, and many artists, scientists or academics with leftist affiliations who failed to denounce communism became unemployed and blacklisted.
Don't forget to share the Rumble link to today's programme to help us grow our audience. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. This has been The Conversation. Until next time.
Nairobi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hossein Latifi and you're listening to the program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the previous episode, we talked about different principles and aspects of the discussion of humanity in the Holy Quran. And we ended up in the discussion of the distinction between dunya and akhara. In the journey of perfection of man, this distinction is very important because those who reduce their sight to this dunya, they cannot understand the plan that Allah has for humanity. The belief and faith in the hereafter is a major player in the overall perfection of mankind. We were talking about the comparisons that Quran makes between the life of dunya and akhirah, and the way it describes life of dunya. One thing that is repeated in the Holy Quran in different verses is the concept of those who sell their akhirah for dunya. They engage in a kind of transaction in which they sell their akhirah, they sell their hereafter, they sell their eternal happiness in order to get something in this dunya, some transient, something that is short-lived in this dunya. And Quran says this is true loss in different verses. Also, Quran gives the example of those who sell their dunya, sell their lives for to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for akhirah. Inna Allah ishtara min al-mu'minin. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala buys from mu'min, purchases from mu'minin anfusahum wa amwalahum. Either their soul, talking about martyrs, or amwalahum for those who make donations in the righteous way, in the ways of spreading religion and spreading virtues among people, charity, helping others. All of these are examples of making a deal with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In other words, it says man alladhi yuqridu Allah qardan hasana, those people who lend their money to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala either in this dunya or in the hereafter pays them back to the extent that they don't even expect it. So this also is there, the concept of selling one's akhirah for dunya, or selling one's dunya for the sake of akhirah. And Quran, by this example, tries to show us that human perfection can happen in this way as well. Or human loss, the loss of perfection by selling akhirah for dunya. A person not knowing the value of something. For example, imagine there's a kid who does not know the value of gold. And then a person comes to her and says, okay, give me that ring, golden ring, and I give you, I don't know, this snack, which is very delicious. And the kid doesn't know that golden ring is equal to many, many more snacks. And she makes the deal. And then when she grows up or she's informed about the wrong decision that she's made, she can't do anything about it. The same is true for people who sell their akhira, who don't know the reality, the value that they have, their soul has, or the eternal position that they could enjoy because of something in this dunya. Only because they could understand the pleasure of this dunya more easily. And they did not know the value of the hereafter and the things in the hereafter. May Allah help us in making right decisions in the dilemmas that we have in our life. We go for a break and we come back for continuing.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to the program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the comparisons between dunya and akhirah. And we said that this dunya is, in comparison to akhirah, is very small. But it doesn't mean that Quran discourages us from dunya and all the pleasures and blessings of dunya altogether. No, we know that there are verses of the Holy Quran. For example, one famous prayer that I think almost all Muslims, they make. رَبَّنَا أَتَنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَا وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَا. Quran encourages us to ask for the blessings of dunya as well. Or for example, when Quran talks about some prophets, like for example, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, says, وَآتَيْنَاهُ فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَا. We have given Ibrahim in this life حَسَنَا, blessing. وَإِنَّهُ فِي الْآخِرَةِ لَمِنَ الصَّالِحِينَ. And also on the day of judgment, he will be among the righteous. Or for example, فَآتَاهُمُ اللَّهُ ثَوَابَ الدُّنْيَا. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives them in description of some believers, faithful. Allah says, we have given them ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة, and the best blessings of the hereafter. And also about Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, وَلَقَدْ اصْطَفَيْنَاهُ فِي الدُّنْيَا. We have chosen him in this life. وَإِنَّهُ فِي الْآخِرَةِ لَمِنَ الصَّالِحِينَ. So the blessing of this dunya is not bad. As I said, this is actually a necessary constituent in the perfection of mankind. And ignoring dunya altogether is not something that Quran recommends. Actually, Quran criticizes those who abandon dunya completely, and he refers to them as ruhbaniyatan ibtada'uha. They created, innovated something that was not part of their religion. Some of the people of previous religions, they abandoned dunya and they left the pleasures of dunya altogether, and Quran discourages that. The fact of the matter is that, or the main secret, as I said, is to know what is the true life and the real thing that we have ahead of us, and what is a short period of time that we have in this dunya, and to maintain a balance, especially in the moments of life that we want to make decisions, never to fall to the traps of ghurur, deception of dunya. Mata'ul ghurur, another keyword that Quran uses for dunya, that it deceives people. And the description of that deception is interesting. Because dunya displays itself, the life of this world displays itself as if it is enduring and it continues forever, while it is not. Many people think that the life of the world continues forever, but it does not continue forever. And at the same time, they think their actions finish. For example, if I tell a lie now, if I do this, it finishes. It's only some seconds that I tell a lie and it finishes. While in fact, it is your action that remains and stays with you. And it is the dunya that leaves you alone. You see the opposition here. Exactly the opposite of what we think. We think dunya continues to stay and our actions are fading away, while in fact dunya is fading away and our actions will remain for us for eternity. We ask for help from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and we seek refuge to Him from our mistakes and from the deception of dunya. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, a Saudi delegation.